We've spent a lot of time getting familiar with the human costs of war in recent weeks, leading up to tonight's premiere of the documentary Debt of Honor on PBS. Today we'll get to know one man's story very well. Retired Army Staff Sergeant Travis Mills came back alive from his third tour of duty in Afghanistan, but he also came back gravely wounded. And when all the surgeries were done, he had lost both arms and both legs, the result of an improvised explosive device, or IED. The picture on the cover of Travis's book shows him standing on artificial legs, sporting an artificial arm and hand. The book is called Tough as They Come. Travis Mills is now a motivational speaker and an advocate for veterans and amputees. And as advocacy includes starting the Travis Mills Foundation, the book's co-writer Marcus Brotherton is a journalist with more than 25 books to his credit. Travis Mills joins us today. Sergeant, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Good morning.
Let's start with the now. 3.5 years since the explosion. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, very well. I'm fortunate to be able to write a book, tell my story, and hopefully help people through any situations they come up against, whether it's traumatic injury like myself or if it's just something they're dealing with that they can't seem to look past. And it's been a pretty fun ride.
So the motivational speaking sounds like it's for broader audiences, not just military folks.
It is. This book right here, Tough as They Come, it doesn't just need to draw in military folks. It doesn't have to have people that have traumatic injury. If you enjoy the movies, The Notebook, if you enjoy the movie Saving Private Ryan or American Sniper for the action, and if you enjoy the movie Forrest Gump, because I'm telling you what, I'm kind of goofy in a good way, you're going to love this book, and I've had really good feedback, and I'm just thankful that that we could write it.
We had been as a country at war for several years by the time you enlisted. Why did you want to be in the military?
Well, I needed something different. I went to college, and I just didn't really know what I wanted to be yet, and I thought I'd rather not be in debt and figure out what I wanted to be and go back. And I just went into the recruiter, and they had some great choices for me. But I went and think I was going to be an electrician or something, and then they showed me airborne infantry, and I said, yep, that's the one, because I really like adrenaline. So I went into the airborne infantry and ended up Fort Bragg in August of 2006.
What in particular, Travis, appealed to you about the work in Afghanistan?
It's not just all about the fighting and everything. We were building schools and roads and helping the communities with fresh drinking water, letting children, especially girls, go to school, which was new, and it's part of what my country thought we should do, and I think that it was great, and I went over there for the guy on my left and my right, and I went 3 times.
You describe in the first pages of the book the dangers over there and a lot of uncertainty. In fact, the first vignette is about going into a community and you're giving kites to the kids, and most of the kids are ripping them up. I mean, you really had a hard time, it sounds like, knowing who was going to be on your side any given day.
Oh, absolutely. And it just goes back to, we do our best. We try. We build the relationships. We let them know we're there for them. But when we have Taliban running behind us and cutting their hands off and torturing them and telling them not to work with us, it's really hard to gain their trust. But every time that our unit went over there, we did gain the trust, and we secured the region, and we pushed out our security bubble. And, the methods that we had in place really did work for us.
It sounds like a fair number of sleepless nights, though.
Well, we were in shifts. Uh-huh. But I love my job. I didn't have to go on my third deployment. I had orders taking me somewhere else, and I went to my sergeant major, and I looked at him and said, "Sergeant Major, my wife and I discussed it, and I don't think it's fair for me to leave right before we deploy, even though the big Army says I should go somewhere else. I have guys that I trained that are out of high school that only know me as a leader, and it's my job to keep them alive and keep them moving, and I don't feel comfortable with someone else doing it because those are my guys." And he understood, and it was postponed or whatever, orders were canceled, and then after my next deployment, when I got home, I was going to go somewhere else. Probably they would have made me, but I wanted it. I wanted to go and take care of my guys, and my wife understood it. She understood the brotherhood that comes along with the military and the service.
She struggled with it a little bit, though, didn't she?
She did. We had a baby that was going to be born, but it's just part of the job. I was a high-ranking E6 in my unit or my platoon, and the guys would come over, and they're not from Fort Bragg. So they're just like us, kind of transplanted to a base, and it was a real family, and she understood the duties of my job as well as the dangers. She went there 1 year at a long deployment with me before. So it's just how it works out. There's a brotherhood that's formed that's just, it's unbreakable.
Which led you to go back there, obviously, with the tragic results. Describe, if you would, the general scene on the day of the explosion, where you were and what was going on.
Oh, absolutely. I was in right outside of our strong point in the Maywand area, outside of Kandahar. Normal day, sun was shining. We had we actually was to have a day off of refit, so just normal, make sure all weapons are clean and all the ammo counts done, and just normal things to do over there. And then a call came in that they had an IED threat, and they wanted us to check it out. So we got our gear on and walked out and went to an area that I thought was safe and secure because we cleared it with the minesweeper not once but twice. And after the minesweeper didn't ping anything, I set my bag down. Once I set my bag down, everything changed in a matter of a second. And that was on April 10th of 2012. And the bag hit the ground and ripped my right arm, right leg off, completely disintegrated. Never found them. The left leg was ripped off, a couple pieces of tendon and muscle and skin holding on, so they duct taped it to my thigh. And my left hand was still there. My wrist was blown out really bad. And my ring and pinky finger were mangled up. But I actually radioed my LT, and I told him I'd just been hit. We're going to need some guys over here to help out with that. And my medic started working on me, and I told him, save my guys. Like, I didn't think I was going to make it. Not that I was suicidal or wanting to die, but I just didn't think that with the injuries I had sustained, there was much hope for me. I saw guys go for a lot less. But that's just a credit to Battlefield Medicine, as well as my medic and the other medic that came running up. They worked so hard to make sure my arteries got clamped off and I stopped bleeding so bad and got me in a helicopter. And once you get to Kandahar, it's the most amazing hospital. 99% people that make it there alive leave there alive. So that's just, I'm truly grateful for that.
Travis Mills was a staff sergeant in the U.S. Army based in Afghanistan. He's now retired. He, as you just heard, lost four of his limbs, all four of his limbs in Afghanistan in an IED explosion. He's written a book about that with Marcus Brotherton. It's called Tough as They Come. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The excruciating detail in the book and that you just related here, I'm surprised you remember that much of it. I mean, you hear a fair amount from people who've been in incidents like that who really don't remember much.
Well, I don't know why, but they say military traumatic injury, you remember more than out in the civilian world. I'm not sure if it's our training or what we're told to experience, we might experience or we might see, but I was awake the whole time. They actually knocked me out on the operating table. I kept telling, quit touching me, I'm fine, leave me alone.
Hmm.
And they said, I don't know how you're still awake, Sergeant Mills. They knocked me out. Last thing I said, my baby girl, I'm never going to see her again. And then they pulled my pants off, and my left leg came with it, so I became a triple amputee. And I don't mean to say it so matter-of-factly. I mean, I didn't have much hope at surviving. I just wanted my guys to make sure they survived. I knew the government would take care of my family, and it just was an unfortunate day at work. Then you have to deal with the mental, am I a bad person? Did I do something wrong in life? Is this punishment? Does God hate me? And things like that. But then you just kind of, you realize it's just, something that happened, and there's two choices you can make. One is go forward. And one is, just sit complacent and have someone spoon feed me. And I told my wife when I woke up in the hospital, I told her to take my 6-month-old little girl, take herself. The house is hers, the cars are hers, all the money is hers. I'll keep paying for whatever they need as much as I can, of course, and don't worry about it. Like, she doesn't have to put up with this. And she was a little offended.
Just a little.
And she's like, that's not why I married you, and that's not how it works. And she stayed by my side, and once I realized she was going to stay by my side, and my little girl's laying on my stomach, and I have tubes and, IV lines and bandages and everything running all over me, and she's grabbing my nose, and I can't defend myself, or my six-month-old grabbing my nose, giggling at me, and I realized, I'm her dad. I'm the one going to be showing her how to do things. I'm the one that will have to teach her how to ride a bike or have to take her to school or get ice cream. And I just decided right then and there, okay, well, they're going to stay by me. I'm going to work hard every day. And I turned my therapy into that you do 1 hour a day of each occupational physical to 4 hours a day of each, 8 hours a week, or 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week, just determined. And I was really thankful that I had a retired corporal walk into my room who's a second quadruple amputee. And he said, you're going to be fine. I drive, I do all this stuff. And once I realized it could be done, it was just about getting it done. And then I started talking and mentoring and peer counseling other soldiers and service members that had been wounded, because at Walter Reed, fortunately, all the amputees go there, and fortunately for me, I'm the worst you're going to see. So only one of the quadruple amputee came in a month after me, and everybody else had legs and arm, but nothing like to my extent. So I was able to talk to the soldier, the family, the wives, let the kids see what progress they can expect, and then really help motivate them to know their life is not over, and kind of answer some of the questions I had that took me a while to figure out.
Yeah, there are some pictures in the book, and you were talking about that moment with Chloe, and the caption points out that you were a little afraid to see how Chloe would respond to you at 6 months. This is your daughter. Your wife is Kelsey. But she was fine. I mean, it was like, here's daddy. Was that really the essence of what she did, right?
Absolutely. And I thought, you know, I'm going to be a monster. And I really don't want to sit inside the house or sit set life out, I guess, like be on the sidelines. So I take my daughter to school. I let the kids all talk to my hand and think it's voice activated, tell them I work with Iron Man. I don't wear my right arm because it has missiles in it. But I figure instead of hiding from this, I might as well just be out and open with everything. And it doesn't bother me. People stare at me and they stare long enough. I'm just like, hey, how's it going? I'm Travis. And I'll start the conversation. And fortunate for me, I'm mentally fine. I'm the same person I was before. I just have to put my legs on and then my pants. But besides for that, it's just there's a little bit of difference in my life. I'm a little more patient than I used to be. And I want people to know it's not so much all about the military and the explosion. I mean, this book covers some great stories about my wife and how we met.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my wife and I, when we met, my brother-in-law, he was a medic. He went home in 2007 in September to watch his daughter be born. And his little sister, 18, saw a picture of this 20-year-old, 6'3", 265, 75-pound behemoth of a man, good-looking sort, if
right.
you ask me. And she sent a MySpace friend request, and I hit accept. And we started chit-chatting. The first time we ever met, I actually flew into Dallas to pick her up to go on our vacation that we had planned to Mexico. And
yeah, you guys didn't waste any time, I noticed, from reading that part of the book. Travis Mills is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book about coming back from being a quadruple amputee after an IED explosion in Afghanistan is called Tough as They Come, co-written with Marcus Brotherton. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's come back to the beginning. You're from a small town in Michigan. It sounds like a kind of an idyllic childhood.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you just take the Andy Griffith Show, basically, it's a real wholesome, great place to be from. And played football, baseball, basketball, and, you know, got my little bit of trouble, you know, normal stuff growing up, nothing with, like, cops or anything. And just regular small-town, you know, kid. I was a grocery packaging engineer for 4 years. So
you learned the military lingo, I hear.
Oh, yeah. Well, I used that one in high school. I learned that when I was running for youth and government.
Uh-huh.
It was in one of my speeches. But, yeah, I was a bagger at a grocery store, you know. And then I went to college, played some football. And after football season ended, I didn't know what I really wanted to do with myself. And I decided to move back home. And after being at home for a little bit, I just decided I was going to go to the military.
So you're the middle child, but it sounds like you always acted like the oldest.
Yeah, well, I mean, I like to tell people when I get on stage, which I'll actually tell, I'm going to Microsoft today and talking for a little bit. I'm going to tell them, there's a picture of my mom. I tell them, April 14th, 1987, mom and dad's favorite day in the whole entire world. No, it's not the day they got married. That's my birthday. And I tell them that they had three kids, and I was the middle and the favorite, because the first one they had, they was like, woo, we got to try this again. They had me, perfection, thought they had the magic serum, had the last one. We've got to cut it off at the middle one being our favorite. The other two will keep around until 17. But that's just more of a joke. My sister, my mom and dad, my brother would never say that.
Right. And Travis, it sounds like you always had a sense of humor. Were you a class clown type?
I was. But, you know, there was times where I was, you know, that's a horrible joke. I was going to tell you, like, the teachers always told me to be quiet and quit talking to class. And now I go around and speak throughout the nation. But every time I got disciplined in school, I deserved it. Probably some I didn't get that I should have.
You're not a fearful kid by any measure. Weren't a fearful kid by any measure. Not a kid anymore, obviously. What was your thing about fish, though? This is an interesting side.
Oh, I don't know. I couldn't tell you. Something about not being able to see what's underneath me in the water. I kick and punch the water. It's still, I'm a lot braver now. My daughter's in the water, and she's fine. I'm like, okay, it's cool. Like, my daughter's in. I got to be brave. My next thing I want to do, actually, because I go skydiving and things like that and snowboarding, I want to actually go great white shark cage diving,
uh-huh.
Great white sharks. And I'm not even joking about that. Like, I really want to face that fear and jump that hurdle. So I'm pretty excited that I'm going to hopefully find a way to do that.
Wow, you really do want to push the envelope. A lot of this, it sounds like, comes from your dad. I mean, what did he always tell you about what to do when you meet obstacles in life?
Oh, you just got to push through. I mean, you know, you never quit anything. You always keep going. And I don't know, my dad, he's an awesome, awesome guy. You know, always taught me do the right, you know, the hard right over the wrong, or the easy wrong, or you can't say enough about him. My grandpa and me have the same personality as well, so that works out. My grandpa and me are really good friends, too.
There's one particular story about your father, you know, just kind of shaking his head, like, okay, do it till you get it right. And it was about you bringing stuff into the barn, I guess, with a tractor or a front-end loader.
Yeah, a front loader I took into the barn, and I smacked the side of the barn, knocked the wall almost right off the foundation. it stalled. I hit so hard, it stalled the tractor. I was a big case backhoe. And then he come out, and I thought I was in so much trouble. He told me, get back on there. He had to back it up. He said, you got to come around this way, not swing it so wide. But, yeah, he just, life lessons, and he just always wanted you to get it right rather than make you feel bad for getting it wrong.
So you took up sports, it sounds like, fairly young, not surprising for a kid who was growing up to be a big strapping kid. You did to karate, is that right?
I mean, I'm not going to brag, but I guess I'm going to right now. 1993 karate state champion in Michigan.
All right.
I mean, my mom was a higher belt than me, but that's because she did the kata things, and I didn't really care for it. I just wanted to spar. And I've only been in one fist fight in my whole entire life, I'll be honest. I knocked myself out playing volleyball. I wish that was a joke. I really do.
How did you knock yourself out playing volleyball?
I kept going over the net. We made a makeshift court over in Afghanistan with antenna cables and 550 cord and, you know, I don't know, like nylon cord and stuff. And I was swinging over the net really hard, and I brought my hand back, and they kept yelling at me for going over the net. So I brought my hand back really fast, and the knuckle on my right hand, right at the base of the thumb, caught me right in the eye socket. And I stumbled around and fell right over. That's the only fist fight I've ever been in. So I'm not sure if I won or I lost, or I guess it's a draw. And then I always wondered, do I get knocked out easy, you know, or will I go, you know, do I hit really hard where it could be detrimental to my future because I might end up incarcerated? And then I hit a bomb built for a truck, didn't get knocked out. But it's probably better that I was a gentle giant.
Wow, you were a big kid. Travis Mills, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange's book, As Tough As They Come. Beyond the physical, how good a student were you in school?
You know, I didn't really buckle down probably until junior, like mid-sophomore to junior or senior year. So I graduated at 2.8, 2.9, and that really hurt me because colleges were looking for sure for football and baseball, and they wanted me to go academic probation at these Division I schools for 6 months because I needed a 3.2. And my mom and dad always told me, I mean, it's the same old thing. You know, you always think your parents aren't smart until you get older and like, wow, you really were right on that. And I wish I would have done better, but you can't change a path. And I'm just fortunate I'm be able to help my daughter with her homework and do the same things to encourage her and make learning fun and things like that.
You were big enough for the NFL. Is that right?
I believe so. I ran a 4.5, which is pretty fast for a 6'3", 250 pound guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I had, you know, I just wasn't there with the grades, and it just didn't work out for me.
And so junior college ended up owing, what, $9,000 or something after going off to?
Yeah, because I had an apartment and I was in everything like that, so I probably should have went somewhere else, but it's not the way it worked out. And then I had me come up where I went back home to try to do college there for a semester and figure it back out. And I went from having no rules in my own apartment to having my parents like, hey, get in by this time at night and this and that. Not that I was a wild child or anything, but I needed to, you know, I didn't like always trying to figure out like what McDonald's dollar menu meal I was going to eat. I wanted to have some kind of income and some kind of future. So I went to the military and ended up loving it.
You had an open mind, it sounds like, about service branches, though, Travis. What made the Army the choice?
I'll be honest with you. The Marines and the Navy, I went there and talked to them. And then I went to the Marines and talked to them. I got real excited. Then I went to the Army and talked to them. Well, the Army was offering a bonus of $24,000. So I went to the Marine guy, gentleman again, and I said, so what's your guys' bonus? And he said, we don't get bonuses. We give honor, duty, respect, loyalty. I goes, no, I get that. It's on the same poster over there in the Army branch. I'm just saying, like, money-wise. And he got frustrated. I went to the Army branch, and they offered me $24,000. I thought, well, I can pay off some college debt right there. And I signed up, and I got the money and went to the Army and ended up really enjoying myself.
Tell us about your parents, though, and their struggles with your decision. I mean, obviously, you're talking about signing up in, what, 06?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is when things are still pretty hot, both in Iraq and Afghanistan. So what were your parents making of your decision?
My mom was really scared. My mom, she knew I was really going to like the Army. I liked the team and the brotherhood, and she didn't want me to go. My dad, he was a little upset. He was in the military as well, so he was in the Army, and he thought it would be a bad idea because he knew I'd end up overseas, and no parent wants their kid in any kind of danger or harm, so I understood. But at the end of the day, I was 18, and I wanted to try something new, and I did it myself. And then after I signed up, they were behind me, full support. They were just worried about what could happen, I guess, for pretty good reasons if you look at me now.
You knew other families with people in the military, didn't you?
I did. I was home on, I mean, we had a lot of people, but I was home on Christmas break before I went to Afghanistan for my first deployment in late January. And I was sitting there at the house, and we got a phone call. I got a phone call from some friends that were overseas in the Marine Reserves, and they had told me a kid from my town had died. He was shot in the heart by an armor-piercing round from a sniper in Iraq. And his dad was my baseball coach for, like, probably 6-7 years, you know, from little kid to, middle school and up to Pony League or whatever. And my brother was actually, at the time, dating his little sister, so I had to tell my mom, like, hey, she has to go home, you know, and I couldn't tell her what happened because the Marines hadn't informed the family. But it was rough for my mom because she realized I was going over to Afghanistan in a war zone, and that kind of thing is real, and it's not a joke over there.
Sure. And before you get there, though, I mean, you have to go to boot camp and all, and a guy like you, often the leader, often the center of attention, what was that like to be one of many?
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't want to stand out. First day of basic training, I walked in, the drill sergeant said, everybody gets coleslaw. And I, for one, don't like coleslaw, but I was not going to test it. So I got a scoop of coleslaw, ate it first, and then I came back to dinner thinking, oh, good, no more coleslaw. And he looked at me and said, Mills, you liked it so much, you ate it first, you get two scoops of coleslaw. So for 2 weeks, I ate two scoops of coleslaw. I didn't think I've ever told the drill sergeant, I haven't ran into him since, to tell him I didn't really like coleslaw. But it was better not just to blend in, not to stand out, because it just didn't make sense to stand out at all when you're in basic training, because those guys, if you made it a point to stand out, they made it a point to make an example out of you.
Is it kind of like a psychic rolling pin? They want to make sure everybody's flat, then they build them up again into something new?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They absolutely want to make sure you understand a part of something greater than yourself, and they do that. And I was looked up to by a lot of guys. I mean, I had leadership roles in the platoon, but I wasn't the one standing out doing the wrong thing. I was always making for the most times making the right choices. Except one time, we got on our 36-hour pass, and my mom and dad told me, oh, yeah, 10 o'clock starts the ceremony. It started at 9, because they were going to tell you couldn't take your uniform off, you couldn't do this.
Mm-hmm.
So they came at 10, and they were just there to pick me up. And then I got to the hotel, took my uniform off, and as I was walking into a movie theater with my parents, they happened to catch me out of uniform. So I got in a little bit of trouble there.
Whoops. Okay. More issues from boot camp and other stuff to talk about with Travis Mills. His book is Tough As They Come, about his experience as a quadruple amputee from an IED in Afghanistan. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Travis Mills, and we'll take phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. .36 on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're continuing a discussion we started in the first part of the hour with Travis Mills. It's our continuing effort to learn more about the human costs of war leading up to tonight's premiere of the documentary Debt of Honor on PBS. Staff Sergeant Travis Mills was serving in the U.S. Army on his third tour of duty in Afghanistan when he set his backpack down after a minesweep and an IED went off underneath. Eventually, he ended up with no arms and no legs and worked his way back with artificial limbs to do all the things he really wants to do in life. Tough As They Come is the book he wrote with Marcus Brotherton. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Travis, let's talk about the basic idea of the infantry. This is not something that comes easily. I think the most human beings are supposed to shoot and kill people. Talk about getting your mind wrapped around that concept in training.
Well, it just, it's a job. They tell you everything you do when they prepare you for going to dinner even. You have to take two steps to get into the right line. So you say one shot, one kill. And then you yell, once you turn, you say kill, we will. And then it's, steady, aim, squeeze, fire, shoot, move, communicate, kill. It's just a very real situation. But it's what they train you to do. You go into the infantry, knowing that that's the job you chose. They have it really, the guidelines are wrote out right there in front of you. But did I want to kill people? No, I didn't go in as like a serial killer or murderer or anything, but just was part of the job, and I went over there to do my job, and if anybody tried to shoot at me and take my life, then I was, defending myself.
The 82nd Airborne Division, possibly the best-known military unit there is. How did you get in?
Well, I had options. They said I could go to Fort Bragg, or I could go to Italy, I could go to Fort Polk, Louisiana, or I could go to somewhere else. I don't want to bring that name in here. But, no, I just chose Fort Bragg. A lot of my friends were going there. It was kind of funny. There was 29 guys that chose to go to Fort Bragg. And I got to Fort Bragg, and out of those 29 guys, they're all my buddies. I got stationed with none of them. They all went to 1st Brigade or 2nd, and I went to 4th Brigade. So it kind of backfired on me, I guess, to go there, but with my friends. But I really enjoyed the unit, and I was thankful to be there in the historic unit, get my Red Beret, and you know, go on our horribly long runs. Like Monday was 8 miles, Tuesday was 4, Tuesday was 2 miles, Wednesday was 4, Thursday was 2, and Friday was like 13 miles sometimes.
Ouch. That's a lot. You you describe your first deployment to Afghanistan. What was the job there? What was the order?
I was a personal security detachment for a lieutenant colonel of a battalion. So it was kind of nice. I was E2, a 19-year-old private, and we worked in a small team. It was a, you know, really big boy style feel. There wasn't yelling at, you know, privates and the things you see in movies. It was just like, hey, you got this done? I'm like, yep, got it done, no problem. And we went about our business. And then halfway through the deployment, as I made rank and got to be a specialist, you know, PFC specialist, I got put in charge of a Humvee. So I was the one calling the shots if we shot into somebody or if we didn't engage them or making sure the truck was signed for. I had like $1.5 million dollars worth of equipment signed to me that I was responsible for. And just amazing the military would give me that kind of responsibility.
I want to be clear here that you're not talking about liking anybody on the other side here, but you do describe what appears to be something like respect for the Taliban. I mean, what were you told, and what else did you try to learn about the enemy over there?
Well, I mean, we understand they're not dumb people. They understand what they're doing. They're very well versed in the art of war, and they know that they can shoot at us, drop the gun, blend into the population, and walk away, and nobody will catch them. So you always have to keep your eyes ready and make sure you look for the signs that they teach you. You know, is the guy going to be a suicide bomber? Is he completely shaved face? Is he nervous and sweating? Is he acting kind of irrational? Is are they using kids for stuff? It's just, it's a whole bunch of different things that they teach you to look for that will help you in situations determining whether it's a threat or a non-threat person.
We have an email here from Bruce in Ashland. He writes, I think young people need to be more responsible about going to war. I listened to you to find out why doing a little good in a sea of evil attracts you. Remember the forces that installed the CIA-backed Taliban, the increase in heroin on American streets after the U.S. invasion. Remember the stand-down allowing the 9/11 attacks. Recognize the lies that started the Vietnam War. Bruce writes, if young people knew more about what they were doing, maybe they wouldn't go. How concerned were you about American history in recent conflicts and any of what Bruce is talking about there when you signed up?
Well, I signed up where the country needed us to go. It wasn't really a choice for me whether I wanted to go or not. I didn't, you know, once they said we're deploying, everybody wants to go and do good, and you know, everybody has somebody that they lost either in 9/11 or somebody that they lost overseas as a friend or a family member, and you know, I wasn't going over there out for blood or vengeance. I was going over there because my country asked me to, and that was my job. Whether, you know, you look at the research or not, the military provided a great job. It paid me. It made sure I was clothed and I had food. It made sure my family was taken care of. And I have no regrets about what I did, and I don't think there was anything done. I mean, I didn't break the law or do anything negative over there, so one thing I can say is this is a voluntary military. Nobody is drafted anymore. So as far as people wouldn't go or anything like that, that's not the case. There's people signing up getting turned away at the recruiters because we're overpopulated in the military or they don't fit the criteria to get in.
Travis, what were the first two deployments in Afghanistan like, just for the general range of action, firefights and casualties around you, things like that?
First one was pretty light. First one didn't see very much. Had a suicide bomber run up on us 2 weeks in, a couple other intense situations, but nothing too crazy. And that was 15 months. And that the second one was a lot different. The first 6 months, we got in a couple firefights, ended up taking out high-value targets the first night we got to new areas. So the area was supposed to be high intensity. It went really, really quiet. And then we had one heck of a fight up north in the Bab el-Maghab region where they needed us to backfill. So they took our platoon and we backfilled and it replaced some people that needed our help. And it was kind of game on for 4 months of constant firefights and taking ground and holding ground and, you know, really, really getting after it, doing our job, living out of mud huts, taking 4 showers in a whole entire year, and things like that. But it was our job. We enjoyed it, and we were there for each other. And then we came home, and that was that. That was it.
After that second deployment, I mean, granted, after that one was a bit harder than the first. I mean, was there any question in your mind though about returning for that third, since your unit was going back?
No, I re-enlisted actually. I re-enlisted on Christmas Day, or the day after Christmas, on my second deployment, because I knew that I wanted to go back. I wanted to be there with the guys overseas, just like when you watch the movie American Sniper, and Chris Kyle really wants to be back over there with the guys. There's still a war going on. There's still Americans over there getting killed, and you just want to go back and try to help out with any situation you can.
So let's move up to the aftermath of the explosion. There were two other guys wounded when the IED went off. How did they do?
They're okay. They the right guy, Brandon Fessy, he took trapped into the face and bad concussion and things like that. But he's good. He's in college now. He's doing well. And Ryan, he had some pretty big chunks out of his legs and in his hands and other places. And he's healed up now. He's doing some paramedic stuff out in California. And then he's going to finish up his degree with fire science. He actually had a kid named the kid after me. His middle name is actually Travis. And, I talked to them, and they're doing good. It's just, all wounds heal in time. Like, I don't consider myself a wounded warrior by no means. I hate that term, to be honest with you.
Really?
Oh, I'm not wounded. I mean, I used to be. I have scars. I have awesome scars, to be honest with you, but I'm not at all wounded. I have, I don't like the negative, connotations with wounded. I don't want people to, just like when people say, oh, you're a veteran, you must have that PTSD. I don't have PTSD. It's been 6 to 20% at the most 20%, but 6% is about the average of people that got in the military that actually have PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of been slapped on every veteran and labeled it. So I'm just trying to change that. I don't want people to think that my story is a sob story. No one has to pity me. I don't have any problems with what I did overseas, nor do I have any problems with the things I have going on now. I'm very fortunate and lucky to be alive and saw perspective. I've had friends that didn't make it home. They have wives and children and family members. I would give anything to have them in my situation. So when it came down to me, it was a choice to either get better or not. It's just think about those guys and who I live for. I make sure I, live every day knowing that their family members would give anything to have them in my situation. And I would do, them an injustice if I didn't push forward and didn't keep going, especially the doctors that worked 14 hours on me, nine doctors, seven nurses. Two nurses worked together for 9 hours straight pumping air into my lungs. And I got to meet them and thank them because they were worried I was going to be mad at them or question why they did it and say, I was upset about it. But I thanked them very much. And I said, look, I'm so thankful to be here with my family and the things that I'm able to do because of you guys' hard work and determination.
So speaking of family, it sounds like it took you a while to talk to Kelsey. What was your mind going through? I mean, you already described, you said, take all the stuff, I'll support you. But you were essentially acting like you didn't think she'd want to be with you?
Well, absolutely. I mean, not that she was a bad person, but I love her so much I don't want to put her through this. It was going to be a long road to recovery, and I didn't know what my future really held. I didn't know about prosthetics. I didn't know about the advancements in technologies and things like that. So when I was waking up in the hospital, I was just embarrassed I got hit by the Taliban because I was really good at my job, I thought. I was embarrassed that I had to have someone feed me, help me use the bathroom and things like that, and I didn't want her to have to see me like that because I was, big tough guy, if you will, and took care of everything. And now I was laying in the bed and lost 110 pounds, and what kind of life would she really be able to have with me?
The pain. Talk about going into a ketamine coma.
Absolutely. I'm so thankful that they did that. And the ketamine coma was a trial study. I'm a big case study right now because I had such bad pain from phantom limb pain, thinking my legs are getting ripped off, toenails getting ripped off, legs are on fire, spikes being driven through my heels. Just a whole bunch of excruciating pain, and they were worried I was going to overdose on painkillers because I was getting so immune to the dosage, and they couldn't do anything for me. So they had all these different tests that they did, or trial studies, and the third one they tried was a ketamine coma, and they made me sign a waiver. My wife signed a waiver saying, we don't know what's going to happen. It's only been done one other time in the U.S. and 30 times in the world, and it could fry his brain. But what they did was give me a ketamine coma, and they gave me 600 milligrams an hour for 5 days straight. And what it did was reset my nerve endings to think that where my residual limbs ended was where my nerves ended, instead of trying to find my hands and my feet. And thanks to that kind of, medical breakthrough, I guess, I don't have any pain. I don't take any medication. I took medication only for 6 months after my explosion, then I quit all of it. painkillers, Lyrica, everything. And they use ketamine a lot more for guys in my situation because of the positive results they've had from me.
Travis Mills is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Staff Sergeant, retired from the Army. Tough as They Come is his book. Talk about the rehab and the learning to use the prosthetic limbs. And you're such a great guy with dates, it's pretty clear. You remember everybody's birthday and wedding day and stuff like that. How long between the explosion and the first time you got standing up on artificial legs?
Well, I got the arm. The artificial arm was 5 weeks. I know that wasn't the question, but that's the first one I got was 5 weeks in. I got to be outpatient after 5 weeks. And then the first time standing up on artificial legs was 7 weeks and 4 days. I know that because it was just under 2 months, and I was really excited to say I walked with before 2 months hit.
And how hard was that, though? I mean, it sounds like the rehab and some of the physical therapy was really excruciating.
Yeah, well, the blood pools up in the bottom of your leg. You're on short legs because all your balance comes through your hips and your abdomen now. So I was only like 5'5", looking up at my wife and everything, which was kind of different for me. And I took steps, and they said, you might walk one lap today. It's going to be real hard on your muscles. You know, don't worry. We'll get better every day. And I walked 3 laps that day. And while I was walking, I broke down. I teared up a little bit and thanked them so much for their hard work and how grateful I was to be able to walk. And then I happened to mention I was going to walk without crutches. And then my therapist said, don't you do that. And I said, oh, yeah, I'm going to. And my therapist, Carrie Quinn, who was just amazing. She worked with all the hard, amputee cases. Or not hard, but more, more limbs lost, the more it was likely she was going to get the patient. And as I was walking the last straightaway on the Military Advanced Training Center, I said, I picked my crutches up and said, I told you I was going to walk without crutches because I'm 82nd Airborne. I'm as tough as they come. And we have that on video, and that's where the title of the book actually comes from. That's where Tough as They Come actually originated from. And luckily on the video, they cut this part out of the documentary because I fall over right after I say that. But I took about 5 or 6 steps without crutches, and then the next day I realized, I've found out that failure was going to be part of my success. Not every day was going to be, a success, but it was going to be a step in the right direction. So the next day my dad got to come because he was not able to be there that day, and I said, I'm going to walk 5 laps for you today, Dad. I walked half a lap, my muscles cramped up, I fell over and I couldn't move, and I couldn't walk anymore. My therapist, Carrie, she said, Travis, I should have told you. Like, the second day is always harder than the first. And I'm sorry, because I was in tears telling my dad I was apologizing for not being able to walk 5 laps. And, he was like, no, it's okay. That's fine.
You're right.
And I'm like, I'm so sorry. I should have did better. And I really hold myself to a high standard. And that's what the A2nd, they have all the standards. You just get used to them. You get used to holding yourself to a higher standard. And not that I was better than anybody else, but I just wanted to do as good as I possibly could do.
Travis, what were the toughest things to learn how to do with artificial limbs?
It was all practice. It was all practice, like the knees that I wear, like the X3s that I wear right now. It was just about making sure I knew how to walk the right way. If I stubbed my toe or if somehow I made the brake activate, I didn't want to go down and things like that. But it was just those little things, making sure that I could do that, because if you stub your toe and fall, you go right down. Also, I had to make sure I knew how to get back up. I was out to dinner with a buddy the other day, and I stubbed my toe and went right down. And I had to. He's like, what do I do? I said, don't touch me. I got it. I get on my way. I stood back up.
Really?
But, it was just about learning the muscle flexes and understanding how they work and just repetitive practice.
You started a foundation, the Travis Mills Foundation, right?
I did. I started a foundation because my wife and I wanted to give back to all the love and support that we were receiving from across the nation. Not just my family and her family and our friends and my local community, but across the nation. And sometimes, actually across the world, like people in Australia and, England and all that, or Great Britain. And we wanted to send care packages overseas. So if anybody's listening, you're going to send a care package. I want you to understand that it's pepper beef jerky, peanut butter M&Ms, gummy bears. Gummy worms will work in a pinch, but gummy bears and Orbit gum. That's all they want.
Really?
Easily. That's all I want. And then it turned out that I had such a great time going out to Colorado and learning how to downhill mountain bike, where it was just gravity. And I had the brakes to my thighs, and I was going down switchbacks and 200-foot drop-offs. I could have, been messed up on really bad. Then I learned how to kayak and canoe, and I said, it would be great to be able to bring the families to this, because I was fortunate I could travel with my family, with my wife. But that's because due to funding and things, we couldn't take all the families. So I founded the foundation, and we had 2 proof of concepts the last 2 years, and we were able to bring out 4 families the first year and 6 families in that last year. And we had them do kayaking, canoeing, boating, swimming, fishing, tubing. We had the Bass Pro Fishing Tour, Maine Bass Pro Fishing Tour, took guys out and their families to the hot spots and taught them, you know, talked about fishing and stuff. And these guys and the wives and the kids all loved it. And I got thinking, you know, we should do this more on a grander scale. So we actually ended up buying the Elizabeth Arden Estate in Mount Vernon, Rome area of Maine. And it's under massive reconstruction right now. So it's a $2.7 million project. We're not where we need to be with funding. Obviously, all nonprofits could do, could raise more money. But we also pride ourselves, and I'm the president of the foundation, I will never take a paycheck. And you can put that down in writing. My board will never get paid for any of their work.
All right. It's an amazing tale and really well told. I know you got a busy day ahead of you. You're going to be Microsoft at noon today and then at Joint Base Lewis-McChord at 4 this afternoon. The book is called Tough As They Come. Travis Mills, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange. It's been really good to talk to you.
Thank you, sir. If anybody has any questions, travismills.org for anything else. And I appreciate your time and have a wonderful day.
All right. Take care.